2. Ringing Rocks. Why did we build huge reverberant cathedrals to celebrate the divine? Did our prehistoric ancestors share our appreciation for resonant spaces? These were the questions going through my mind as I stood by the 4 tall, imposing facade stones outside a Neolithic burial mound, blowing up party balloons and smiling sheepishly at other tourists. When I bought the balloons, I had been tempted to choose the black one with skeletons printed on them. What could be more appropriate for a burial chamber? But reluctantly, I had settled for some big yellow and blue balloons made from thicker latex, because they would go with a bassy bang. I had abandoned my bulky acoustic equipment for this field trip. Luckily, I could make surprisingly useful measurements with a pin, a balloon, a microphone, and a digital recorder. I crawled between the entrance stones, and a dank, earthy smell filled my nostrils as I entered the cramped tomb. I set up my microphone in one arm of the cross-shaped chamber, ready to record the balloons bursting on the opposite side. Only in recent years have scientists begun systematically studying the acoustics of prehistoric archaeological sites. And one of the more controversial publications on the subject had brought me to this ancient burial mound only 50 kilometers, about 30 miles north of Stonehenge. The whole region is stuffed with prehistoric remains, including the largest prehistoric stone circle in the world at Avebury, which has 180 unshaped standing stones on a 1.3 kilometer, about 3/4 of a mile circumference, and Silbury Hill, the largest prehistoric mound in Europe. At nearly 40 meters, 130 feet high, made from 500,000 tons of chalk, the man-made hill has no clear purpose. But I was measuring a smaller monument, Wayland Smithy, a 5,410 to 5,600-year-old Neolithic long barrow. To arrive at the long barrow, I had trudged along the muddy Ridgeway, an ancient walking highway in central England on a cold, clear winter's day. Had I been on horseback, I could have avoided the quagmire under my feet and also tested the famous legend of Wayland Smithy, which claims that if you leave your horse tethered overnight along with a silver coin on the capstone, the next morning your steed will be reshod. The barrow is a large, low mound, fringed by a circle of beech trees. Most visitors poke their heads inside, snap a few pictures, and move on, examining the ancient monument through 21st century eyes. But I felt compelled to explore the acoustics. I listened to my footsteps and how the sound changed as I crawled about. I talked out loud to myself to test whether my voice became distorted, and I clapped my hands to seek out echoes. I even plucked up the courage to sing a few notes, using the acoustics of the burial chamber to enhance my otherwise feeble bass. And of course, I burst my party balloons. Acoustic exploration is vital for understanding how our ancestors might have used these ancient sites. Back in Neolithic times, sound would have been even more important than it is today. In a time before writing, being able to listen to someone talking, remember the message, and pass it on was a vital skill. Acute hearing was crucial for avoiding predators, repelling attacks from rivals, and tracking and hunting animals for food. To overlook sound is to render the story of ancient monuments incomplete. We need to explore beyond the visual dominance of modern life and use our other senses, hearing, smell, and touch. An obvious starting point for an exploration of ancient sites is the Greek architectural masterpiece, the Theatre at Epidaurus. A traveller in 1839 wrote, "I could well imagine the high satisfaction with which the Greek, under the shade of the impending mountain, himself all enthusiasm and passion, wrapped in the interest of some deep tragedy, would hang upon the strains of Euripides or Sophocles." What deep-drawn exclamations! What shouts of applause had rung through that solitude! What bursts of joy and grief had echoed from those silent benches! This is a vast, almost semi-circular terrace of grey stone seats, banked steeply in front of a circular stage. Even today, tour guides delight in demonstrating the perfect acoustics, astonishing visitors as a pin dropped on the stage is heard high up on the huge bank of marble seats. Few acoustical situations are so enveloped in myth as the antique Greek theatre, wrote acoustic scientist Michael Barron. For some, the Greeks are credited with an understanding of acoustics which still baffles modern science. Unfortunately, no extant documents reveal what the Greeks knew. But we are not completely bereft of written evidence, because Vitruvius, one of Julius Caesar's military engineers, wrote extensively about the design of Greek and Roman theatres between 27 and 23 BC. What is striking about Vitruvius's book is that the overriding concern is for good acoustics, with less interest shown for visual appearance. Vitruvius provides simple design principles that still apply today. Greek theatres bring the audience close to the stage so that they can hear the sound as loudly and clearly as possible. This is why the audience seating is roughly semicircular. However, for the audience seated to the side of the stage in Epidaurus, the actor's words would still have been rather quiet because the voice naturally projects forward. The solution to this problem was to give the side seats to foreigners, latecomers, and women, the ancient equivalent of cheap seats. Ancient theatres were built in very quiet locations, so that unwanted noise wouldn't drown out an actor's voice. The designs exploited sound reflections, including those from the circular stage floor and scenery. All these reflections reinforced the sound of people speaking on the stage. As the Roman scholar Pliny the Elder noted, "Why are choruses less distinct when the orchestra, stage floor, is covered with straw? Is it due to the roughness that the voice, falling on a surface which is not smooth, is less united so that it is less? Just in the same way light shines more on a smooth surface because it is not interrupted by any obstruction. The straw probably quieted the sound by absorption rather than scattering." Pliny the Elder's comments are relevant to modern homes, which have become much more reverberant now that wooden flooring is more fashionable than carpet. The ancient theatres themselves provide compelling archaeological evidence of an empirical trial and error development of good acoustic design. But there is no indication of anything like a modern scientific understanding. Writing about Vitruvius, academics Barry Blesser and Linda Ruth Salter conclude, "Although some of his insights would be confirmed by modern science, others would prove to be nonsense." The more dubious ideas included the suggestion that a few large vases dotted around the theatre would enhance an actor's voice. As a translation of Vitruvius's writing states, "The voice, uttered from the stage as from a centre, and spreading and striking against the cavities of the different vessels, as it comes in contact with them, will be increased in clearness of sound, and will wake an harmonious note in unison with itself." If only acoustic engineering solutions were that cheap and easy. Unfortunately, the vases would have made little difference to the acoustic. Blow over the neck of a large beer bottle, or more fittingly, a large Roman wine jug, say 40 centimeters or 16 inches tall, and you might hear a low resonant hum. This is the resonant frequency of the air enclosed within the jug. Objects have particular frequencies at which they like to vibrate. Flick a champagne flute with a finger and a distinct tone is heard at the glass's natural resonant frequency. But set a wine jug on the floor next to you at Epidaurus, and what you hear is unlikely to change. Any energy used to get the air in the jug resonating will be lost within the vessel. When you walk past empty beer bottles at a pub gig, the sound does not change. Intriguingly, resonant vases can be found in about 200 churches and mosques built between the 11th and 16th centuries in Europe and in Western Asia. These range from 20 to 50 centimeters, 8 to 20 inches in length, with openings between 2 and 15 centimeters, about 1 to 6 inches in diameter. Unfortunately, there are no contemporaneous writings explaining their purpose. High up in the vast Süleymaniye Mosque in Istanbul, you can see a ring of 64 small, dark circles just below the ornate ceiling of the dome, which are openings for resonators. In St. Andrew's Church, Lidington, UK, there are 11 jars high up in the chancel, 6 in the north wall and 5 in the south. In the Church of St. Nicholas in Famagusta, North Cyprus, holes can be seen that connect to hidden pots and pipes. However, scientific studies have shown they would have been useless. The natural resonant frequencies of some vases do not match the frequencies of speaking or singing, and hundreds of vessels would be needed to have a significant effect. Such myths probably arise and persist because sound is invisible, so the cause of an aural effect is not always obvious. Before the 20th century advent of electronic equipment to record and analyze acoustics, it was impossible to calculate a complicated sound field such as a church. The eminent architectural acoustician Leo Beranek documented some of the myths of acoustics. My favorite is the story of the broken wine bottles found under the stages and in the attics, walls, and crawl spaces of some of the great European concert halls. Were these artifacts evidence of an ancient technique for improving acoustics, as some have claimed? No, just evidence of the drinking habits of construction workers. Another myth Beranek notes is the assumption that wooden auditoriums are best because the walls vibrate like the body of a violin. But actually, it is better to make the surfaces hard so that sound is not needlessly absorbed. Newer halls that are lined with wood, such as the Tokyo Metropolitan Art Space Concert Hall, actually use thin veneers of wood glued solidly onto concrete or other heavy and thick substrates. Greek and Roman theatres are remarkable sonic wonders in which thousands of spectators can hear without the aid of modern electronics. They were clearly designed to achieve good acoustics. But were the Greeks the first skilled acoustic craftsmen? Sound is ephemeral, disappearing as soon as it's made, so it is difficult to know exactly what our ancient ancestors heard. Evidence of prehistoric acoustics is very sketchy. Musical artifacts provide some of the most robust evidence of our ancestors' sonic world. The oldest known wind instruments are flutes made from bird bones and ivory, found in a cave in Geisenklosterle, Germany, about 36,000 years old, from the Upper Paleolithic era. The best preserved is made from a hollow vulture's wing bone. It is about 20 centimeters, 8 inches long, with a V-shaped notch at one end and 5 fingering holes. How can archaeologists be confident that the bones were musical instruments? Holes could be made accidentally. Unbelievably, swallowing and regurgitation by hyenas can create round holes in bones. But the Geisenklosterle bones have signs of deliberate and careful working, implying that the holes were precisely and purposefully placed. A replica was made and played. Treating the vulture's wing bone like a flute and blowing over the edge at one end produces a note. Pretending the bone is like a small trumpet and blowing a raspberry down the tube is also effective. Besides flutes, there is evidence of 30,000-year-old percussion and scraping instruments, along with the prehistoric use of ringing rocks and cave acoustics. A xylophone made from stone might seem an implausible musical instrument, more likely to produce a disappointing clunk than a resonating bong, but certain stones can generate notes. Examples are found around the world, from the tall, slender rows of musical pillars in the Vitala Temple in Hampi, India, which ring like bells, to the large rock gongs in the Serengeti, Africa, made from boulders and covered in percussive marks, which make metallic clangs. Nicole Boivin, from the University of Oxford, has studied the rocky outcrops at Kubgal Hill, southern India. These formations contain boulders of dolerite that create loud ringing tones when hit with granite stones. But did ancient people ever play the rocks? The best evidence is the Neolithic rock art alongside the percussion marks, showing that the site was used for many thousands of years. In a cave at Fieux-Amiers in the south of France, there is a large, 2-meter-high, about 7-foot stalagmite that rings like a gong. Fractures from when it was struck have been dated to 20,000 years ago. Dating percussion marks on rock gongs can be difficult, but in this case the new layers of calcite over the damage give an inkling of the age. What's more, this cave was only recently unsealed, and other prehistoric artifacts found inside indicate when it was occupied. When I was younger, I used to go caving, and I was strictly warned to be very careful of delicate stalactites and stalagmites. Earlier in the mid-20th century, attitudes were more relaxed, allowing an act of vandalism to produce the most fantastical stone instrument. Luray Caverns in Virginia contains the Great Stalactpipe Organ, which entertains visitors and occasionally accompanies brides marching down the subterranean aisle. Andrew Campbell, the tinsmith from the town of Luray, discovered the cave back in the late 19th century. A report by the Smithsonian Institution in 1880 commented, "There is probably no other cave in the world more completely and profusely decorated with stalactite and stalagmite ornamentation. When I visited a year after my trip to Wayland Smithy, I was amazed by the number of formations. They seemed to cover every surface. The curators have lit the cave with bright lights, giving visitors the impression that they're walking around a film set." The organ is toward the end of the tour. In the middle of the cathedral cavern, among a forest of cave formations, sits an item that superficially resembles a regular church organ. But when a key is pressed, instead of compressed air blowing through an organ pipe, a small rubber plunger taps a stalactite, which rings and makes a note. The current instrument uses stalactites covering 1.4 hectares, 3.5 acres of the cavern. It is the largest natural musical instrument in the world, the tour guide proudly announced in a staccato Virginia twang, so rapid that every other sentence was unintelligible. With each key connected to a different cave formation, the organ can play 37 different notes. A magazine article from 1957 reports, "Visitors stand enthralled as melody and chords play all round them. No twinkly tunes these, but full-throated music rolling through the cavern. Apparently I heard a rendition of A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, a 16th century hymn by Martin Luther, but I struggled to pick out any semblance of a tune. It was my own fault. I stood very close to the stalactite that plays the musical note B-flat to get a good view of how it worked. But this meant that the volume balance between the different notes was awry. The cave formations playing the notes are strung out over such a large area that many were too distant and quiet. From where I stood, the music appeared to have only 5 notes, and it was more like a piece of avant-garde experimental music than a hymn. In the middle of the cavern, the balance between notes is better, and the reverberance of the cave adds an ethereal quality to the music. A combination of the natural ring of the stalactites and reverberance in the cavern means that notes start and end vaguely. By standing close to one stalactite, I could examine the quality of one note in detail. It reminded me of a metallic gong or church bell. The Great Stalactpipe Organ was the brainchild of Leyland W. Sprinkle, an electronic engineer whose day job was at the Pentagon. While visiting the cavern, Sprinkle heard a tour guide hit a cave formation with a rubber hammer, and he was inspired to make the instrument. He then spent 3 years armed with a small hammer and a tuning fork, searching for good cave formations. When he tapped a stalactite, it would ring with the cave formation's natural resonant frequency. So his task was to find stalactites that produced a beautiful ringing tone and also had a natural resonant frequency close to a note in a musical scale. As Sprinkle discovered, the most visually impressive formations often failed to produce a sound that lived up to their appearance. Only 2 formations were naturally in tune, so others had to be altered. Sprinkle used an angle grinder to shorten these stalactites, thereby raising the natural frequencies of the cave formations, and eventually he produced a scale of notes that were in tune. Sprinkle certainly did not spend a long time worrying about appearance. The stalactpipe organ looks as if a cowboy electrician botched the cave's wiring. The mechanisms are crudely bolted onto neighboring cave formations and walls, and wires hang loosely and without organization around the space. Leyland Sprinkle is not the only person to become obsessed with making the perfect rock instrument. In the 19th century, Joseph Richardson took 13 years to construct a large stone xylophone out of Hornfels slate from the English Lake District. According to the Journal of Civilization, Richardson was a plain unassuming man, with no refinements of education, but possessed of musical talent. The vast instrument currently resides in the Keswick Museum and Art Gallery in Cumbria, where visitors are actively encouraged to play it. The stones of this rock harmonicon span 2 rows over 4 meters, 13 feet long, with steel bars and bells on two upper levels. The bass notes are poorly tuned, and the tone varies across the instrument. Some stones ring beautifully, like a wooden xylophone, while others sound like a beer bottle being struck with a stick. A better percussionist might be able to coax a more musical sound than I did. One historical account recalls, "The tones produced are equal in quality and sometimes superior in mellowness and fullness to those of a fine pianoforte under the hand of a skillful player." One of the key skills of a good percussionist is the ability to make the mallets rebound quickly, so that they do not inhibit the vibration of the instrument. According to the museum's curator, the whole instrument plays sharp. That is, the frequencies of the notes run higher than the standard scale. To tune the instrument, Joseph Richardson chipped away at each slate bar, gradually raising the frequency of the note. If he removed too much stone, the slate played sharp and there was nothing that he could easily do to flatten the note. According to the Journal of Civilization, the Richardson Rock Harmonicon was so large that it needed three of Joseph Richardson's sons to play it. One playing the melody, the next executing a clever working inner part, and the third the fundamental bass. Its power extends to a compass of 5 octaves and a half, extending, in fact, as high as the warble of the lark, down to the deep bass of a funeral bell. I managed a plodding rendition of God Save the Queen, quite appropriate since Queen Victoria had requested command performances at Buckingham Palace, by what a handbill advertising a public concert described as the original Monstrere rock band. According to the Times, the first performance was one of the most extraordinary and novel performances of the metropolis. The Richardson family toured Britain and the continent playing music by Handel, Mozart, Donizetti, and Rossini. John Ruskin, the great Victorian writer and critic, used to own a lithophone made from just 8 rocks. And in 2010, a new instrument was constructed for Ruskin's old home in the English Lake District. Star percussionist Evelyn Glennie gave a celebratory performance on the new lithophone, which has 48 keys arranged in a sweeping arc around the player. The instrument contains green slate, blue granite, hornfels, and limestone from various local valleys and mountains. Writing in the Guardian newspaper, Martin Wainwright described the different sounds. The clinker gives a short, martial note. The green slate a pure, clear, soft sound. The team of geographers and musicians that constructed this new instrument also investigated what makes a rock ring. The size, shape, and material determine the frequency of the sound. But what intrigues me most is why some stones go bong while others merely clunk. When a percussionist strikes a stone that rings, the energy is held in the rock for some seconds, with the stone's vibration being gradually transformed into sound waves in the air that you hear. The rocks that go clunk lose their energy too rapidly within the stone. Good wine glasses ring when gently tapped, but rest a finger on the edge of the glass and the sound disappears almost immediately. The friction between the glass and the finger dampens the vibrations and prevents the ringing. For rocks, the damping comes from the internal structure of the stone rather than your finger. In 2010, I interviewed violin manufacturer George Stoppani for a BBC radio program about how to choose the right wood for the best sounding violin. He went around his dusty workshop tapping pieces of wood to allow me to hear the different sound qualities. Only wood with the right grain density and microscopic structure produces a clear tone, which rings on for a few seconds. Evidence that it can be used to make a world-class violin. It is similar with rock. Within the stone, vibrations are being passed from molecule to molecule. If there are any cracks or hairline fractures, then it is more difficult for the vibration to travel within the rock and the stone will ring less well. In the age of steam, wheel tappers working on the railways exploited the same principle, checking mechanical defects invisible to the naked eye by tapping the wheels of the trains with a small hammer. Lack of a satisfying ring indicated cracks, which could lead to a catastrophic failure of the wheel. But there is more to this than just cracks. Hit a piece of sandstone and it will not ring, whereas a piece of slate, like those I played at the Keswick Museum, can impersonate a gong. Both stones originated from layers of sediments, but slate has been transformed by hundreds of millions of years of pressure into a denser material with a more ordered molecular structure. Vibrations can pass more easily between the neatly arranged molecules in slate than between the loosely packed grains of sand in sandstone. My wife likes to have long phone calls while wandering around the house. As she walks between rooms, her voice changes in fascinating ways, both for her family in the house and for people at the other end of the phone line. Her voice is stronger and harsher in the kitchen because of the hard reflective tiles and flooring, and clearer and warmer in the living room with soft furnishings, which deaden the sound. The microphone in the handset is picking up a mixture of the sound that travels straight from her mouth and the reflections bouncing off the walls, floor, ceiling, and objects in the room. She cannot sneak into the bathroom during a phone call with me because the bright reverberation is a dead giveaway. Size also matters. Larger rooms tend to create a livelier, booming sound. Now imagine you are a prehistoric person wandering around a dimly lit cave system. Your voice will alter as you move from cavern to cavern, through narrow entrances and down tortuous tunnels. The sound quality varies because of the changing patterns of reflections from the rocks. In large caverns, a booming reverberance might be heard, in extreme cases mimicking the sound of a church. But in smaller caverns and tight squeezes, the key acoustic effect is coloration. An old staff room at my university had an amazing ability to color sound. It was a plain, narrow, rectangular room with chairs lined up on either side. It was like a waiting room at a train station. The first few times I went into the room, I noticed a strange distortion as other people spoke. Moving my head back and forth dramatically changed the timbre of my colleagues' voices. With my head in one position, their speech sounded very bassy and powerful, but elsewhere their voices went all tinny, distorted, and horrible. Colleagues probably wondered if I had been drinking, as I gently swayed back and forth listening to our lunchtime conversations, scientific curiosity trumping self-consciousness. As I moved my head from side to side, voices in the room changed as if someone was rapidly altering the settings on a hi-fi's graphic equalizer. This coloration was caused by a change in the balance of the sound, with some frequencies being boosted while others were suppressed. It might seem odd to talk about the color of a sound, but many of the words we use to describe sounds are appropriated from elsewhere. Bright, warm, dead, live. The link between color and sound goes back many centuries, with Sir Isaac Newton spotting the similarity between the distances prisms spread out light colors and the lengths of strings needed to sound out a musical scale. Even today, acoustic engineers carry out measurements using white and pink noise. When paints are mixed together, they form a particular color because the various pigments alter the frequency balance of the reflected light. Blue paint reflects light of a higher frequency than red paint. Similarly, acoustic engineers use colors to describe the dominant frequencies in sounds. White noise contains all frequencies in equal quantities and hisses rather like a poorly tuned radio. Pink noise contains more low frequencies, so it rumbles with a more thunderous quality. Stairwells with two large, flat, parallel walls are a great place to hear coloration. Just clap your hands and you should hear a shrill, high-pitched note. This is a flutter echo, which is caused by sound bouncing back and forth between the walls, passing your ears over and over again at regular intervals. The frequency of the tone depends on how long it takes for the sound to go from your ear to the walls and back again. If the stairwell is narrow, this round trip is quick. The reflections from the wall arrive quickly, one after another, and a high-pitched note is heard. For wider stairwells, there is a longer delay between the reflections you hear and a lower frequency results. The most extreme flutter echo I have experienced was in Spiegelei, a temporary work of art at Tatton Park, Cheshire, England, by artist Jem Finer. This was a spherical camera obscura, a metal sphere about 1 meter, 3 feet in diameter, on top of what looked like a large garden shed. Stick your head into the middle of the sphere, and you could see images of the park projected upside down onto the inside. The visual distortions being inspired by the artist's memories of taking drugs in the park as a teenager. The exhibition catalogue described the sound inside as distorted and deranged, fitting for a work that was playing on the absurdities of gravity. It was fascinating to see how many people experimented with the acoustic once they poked their head inside the sphere. Like a stairwell, the sphere provided sound reflections arriving at regimented intervals. As the curved walls of the sphere focused the sound, the reflections were particularly strong and the coloration especially marked. You are unlikely to find a perfect sphere in a natural cave. Nevertheless, distinct coloration is heard in caverns. Would prehistoric man have exploited the coloration caused by tight squeezes in caves, or the longer-lasting reverberation offered by large caverns? It would be extraordinary if our ancestors had overlooked these effects, especially when you consider how poor the lighting was and how unusual such acoustic effects would have been in an era before buildings. Indeed, starting in the 1980s, acoustic archaeologists have been building up evidence that rock art is found in places where the sound is especially noteworthy. One of the pioneers of this work is Igor Reznikov. A remarkable discovery in the study of ornate caves is the relationship between painted red dots in narrow galleries, where one has to crawl, and the maxima of resonance of these galleries. While progressing in the dark gallery, crawling and making vocal sounds, suddenly the whole gallery resonates. You put the light of your torch on, and a red dot is there on the wall of the gallery. Sound also appears to have influenced what our ancestors painted. Acoustic archaeologist Stephen Waller tried to put the work on a more robust scientific footing by statistically analysing what appears in each acoustic zone. In a paper in Nature, he wrote, "In the deep caves of Fond du Gaume and Lascaux, the images of horses, bulls, bison and deer are found in regions with high levels of sound reflection, whereas feline art is found in regions of the caves with poor acoustics." It seems that our ancient ancestors were exploiting cave acoustics as they told stories around their drawings, with tales of loud-hoofed animals being amplified by reflections, whereas quiet cats called for no sonic reinforcement. The sheer volume of evidence that prehistoric rock art was influenced by cave acoustics is quite persuasive. But David Lubman, a retired aerospace engineer who has been applying acoustic science to archaeological sites, warns that correlation does not necessarily mean causation. I met David in a Vietnamese restaurant in Los Angeles to discuss his work in archaeoacoustics. His wife, Brenda, accompanied us and took the wise precaution of bringing her own car to allow an early escape, because once you get David talking about his favorite subject, it is very difficult to stop him. High praise for Devoir, another researcher, and Reznikov, and their discovery of that correlation, said David. I think this was a turning point for me. He went on to explain that a proper scientific sound source would have been better than using Reznikov's voice to test the caves, and that the whole methodology is vulnerable to experimenter bias. David's hypothesis is that the painters chose non-porous rocks for their art because they would be easiest to paint. By chance, non-porous rocks also provide the strongest reflections. Sound waves cannot penetrate an impervious surface. The sounds just bounce off it. In contrast, porous rock has microscopic holes, air channels that the sound waves can enter. In acoustics, air is modeled as a viscous fluid, like molasses, except much runnier. And like molasses, air does not like being forced into the small channels. As sound enters these tiny holes in the porous rock, the vibrating air molecules carrying the sound wave lose energy to heat. Consequently, porous stone provides weaker reflections than do non-porous rocks. When you come out to a place like this, where it is very quiet and you can hear the echo and imagine what the ancient people were thinking, there is something hypnotic about it, and it really reaches into certain areas of the brain and the soul, and you hear these ancient voices. This is Stephen Waller describing the experience of visiting outdoor ancient rock art. Waller believes that many people miss a trick when visiting prehistoric sites. Not only should we test the sound close to the paintings by clapping, yelling, or singing, but we also need to step back to search for acoustic effects. Stand back from examples in Australia, for instance, and the effect is almost spooky, he says. Where they've drawn a person and you yell at it, it's like the person is speaking to you. A similar effect is heard at Indian Hill, near San Diego, where sound repeatedly echoes from a cave entrance, as if the rock is calling out, and spirits were speaking back, right from the place where they chose to decorate. To get these effects, the sound reflecting from the wall or cave must be heard separately from the sound going directly from your throat to your ear. And this happens only if you stand back from the surface, so that the reflections are delayed. Unfortunately, most people walk right up to a painting and study it from inches away, talking in hushed voices, says Waller. They never step back and see, or hear, the forest for the trees. I've found rock art difficult to explore as a sonic tourist because many sites have restrictive access to preserve the paintings, and some sites have been altered. I was hoping to see if there was an echo at L'Abri du Cap Blanc in France, which is a stunning frieze of prehistoric sculptures carved into a rock shelter. But I was dismayed to have my sonic explorations thwarted by the building that had been constructed to protect the frieze from the elements. One thing that can endanger sonic wonders is well-meaning conservation that considers only the visual to be important. Waller carried out statistical analysis of Horseshoe Canyon in Utah and Hieroglyphic Canyon in Arizona. The latter is in the Superstition Mountains on the edge of Phoenix, and when I was in the US for the Great Stalactite Organ, I took the opportunity to visit it. I set off at sunrise to avoid the worst heat of the day. It peaked at 41 degrees Celsius, 106 degrees Fahrenheit that day, and admired the stately saguaro cacti dotted over the hillside as I hiked up the 2.4-kilometer, 1.5-mile trail to the Native American rock engravings. The petroglyphs are in a canyon, etched into rocks just above where a stream normally flows. It had dried up when I was there in June. Thousand-year-old geometric shapes, lines of sheep and deer drawn by the ancient Hohokam people, intermingle with more recent graffiti etched by vandals. Not long after I arrived, I was joined by a large, friendly family whose parents had somehow managed to get their children out of bed very early. Unable to make any acoustic measurements, I sat back and listened to the family playing and exploring the space. As the children yelled, a distinct echo reflecting from the U-shaped mountains could be heard. As they ran about the canyon close to the engravings, their footsteps and high-pitched voices were colored by the reflections from the semi-enclosed rocks. But these effects were not just restricted to the area around the engravings. Plenty of unadorned spots had a similar acoustic. The heat was debilitating, even in the shade. I could not help thinking that however interesting the acoustics are in the canyon, the presence of water must have made this place significant to the Hohokam. The only archaeological study into the canyon that I've been able to find says the spring was a natural place for the artwork because that is where sheep would have gathered to drink. At Horseshoe Canyon in Utah, the Great Gallery contains particularly fine, often ghostly figures, some of which are even life-sized. These were described by Polly Schaffsma as dark, tapering, immobile, anthropomorphic forms, painted in dark red pigment, hovering in rows against a sandstone backdrop within arched alcoves and rock shelter. Along the canyon, the four sites where the echoes are strongest are those where the paintings are found. Waller's statistical analysis shows that the probability that this co-occurrence arose by chance is 1 in 10,000. Places with no echoes and good rocks to paint on are not decorated. 90% of drawings in the Horseshoe Canyon include hoofed animals such as bison or buffalo. Waller has suggested that the percussive echoes mimic the sound of the animals moving and stampeding. Slow-motion footage of horses reveals that two of their feet land on the ground almost, but not quite, at the same time, giving a double clop. Stand a few tens of yards from a large, flat surface and clap with a steady rhythm, and you can mimic this sound. But you could also produce the rhythm without the echo. When a hoofed animal walks or gallops, there is a distinct jaunty rhythm to the hooves hitting the ground, something I remember simulating with two halves of a coconut when I was a child. Such theories in archaeoacoustics are necessarily speculative. Some mainstream archaeologists initially doubted David Lubman and his ideas about echoes from Mayan pyramids. As he explained to me, I thought the archaeologists would be jubilant that somebody has discovered something that they had understandably overlooked, but instead they are angry with me. The pyramid of Kukulcan, a Mayan feathered serpent deity, at Chichen Itza in Mexico was built between the 11th and 13th centuries. It is the height of a six-story building, with a square base that is about the size of half a soccer field. On every side it has a staircase running up the middle that contains 91 steps, and at the top there is a square temple. Visit the site, and guides will delight in clapping and producing a chirping sound. Stand in the right place, about 10 meters, 30 feet from the bottom of one of the staircases, and reflections from the stairs create a squawking echo with a distinctive descending pitch. David Lubman claims that this echo mimics the call of the scared and venerated Quetzal bird. Imagine an ancient Mayan priest presiding over a ceremony and, with great theatricality, summoning the sound of the Quetzal bird by clapping his hands. Did this happen? And is there an even greater story to tell about how the Mayans built their pyramids with specific acoustics in mind? Is this perhaps another example of their legendary technological talents, now lost? I will return to the physics of the sound effect in Chapter 4, but for now it is important to know that many staircases can be made to chirp. The Mayan pyramids are not particularly unusual. Rupert Till, a musicologist from the University of Huddersfield, demonstrated this fact while waiting for his X Factor audition at the Old Trafford Soccer Stadium, the home of Manchester United. Till's studies of ancient acoustics made him curious about whether the steps between the terraces in the stadium would behave like a Mayan pyramid. Sure enough, when he clapped his hands, a distinctive chirp could be heard. Now, no sane person would suggest that the stadium steps were deliberately designed to chirp, so why should anyone assume that the echo from the Mayan pyramid is anything but an acoustic accident, or that it was used during ceremonies? David Lubman, however, says it's hard to believe it wasn't intentional, hard to believe it wasn't noticed. And he goes further, explaining that the acoustic phenomenon is connected to the light shadows that are cast on particular days. At the equinoxes, a zigzag shape appears down the side of the staircase, a distinctive shadow forming a tail for the serpent statues at the bottom of the stairs. His explanation is that around the spring equinox, the Quetzal bird undertakes a spectacular diving display, and it looks like a flying serpent. At the bottom of the staircase is the head of the serpent, at the exact point you need to clap to make a chirp. So the echo helps explain the visual display. I think there are three possible scenarios. First, the Mayans deliberately built their pyramids to make serpent shadows and chirping staircases. Second, it was not deliberate design, but the Mayans noticed that their pyramids chirped and then incorporated the sound into ceremonies. Third, and least romantic, modern guides noticed the chirp and made up this tall tale to entertain tourists. Unpacking which of the three scenarios is correct is difficult. It is like examining the orientation of ancient structures to the stars and sun. It is easy to prove that places are astronomically aligned in an interesting way, but proving that such alignment was deliberate is impossible. We can learn from modern examples where documents exist to resolve arguments. There are whispering galleries in the US, Europe, and Asia where you can hear ghostly voices apparently emerging from within the walls. More on this in Chapter 5. With so many places built that have this acoustic effect, it is tempting to assume deliberate sonic design. But most are accidents of design, and none appear to have been exploited for rituals and ceremonies, even the ones within cathedrals. I find it hard to believe that Mayan pyramids were deliberately designed to chirp, but I am open to the idea that the sound might have been exploited in ceremonies. Whichever account of events you believe, an important thing to try at Chichen Itza is to test the chirp and wonder whether, 1,000 years ago, Mayan priests did the same, summoning the Quetzal bird, a messenger from the gods. The wind, playing upon the edifice, produced a booming tune, like the note of some gigantic one-stringed harp. No other sound came from it, Overhead, something made the black sky blacker, which had the semblance of a vast architrave uniting the pillars horizontally. They carefully entered beneath and between. The surfaces echoed their soft rustle, but they seemed to be still out of doors. The place was roofless. What can it be? This dramatic description of Stonehenge comes toward the tragic end of Thomas Hardy's Tess of the D'Urbervilles, where Hardy refers to that famous ring of stones as a very temple of the winds. Disappointingly, the wind-driven drone has fallen silent, probably because many stones were removed and rearranged in the 20th century. But even without the booming tune, the sound of stone circles can surprise because, as Hardy observes, they can have an unexpected indoor quality. Stonehenge is one of the most iconic prehistoric sites in the world. So naturally, it has attracted curious acoustic archaeologists. There have been many suggestions for why ancient denizens built Stonehenge. Ignoring the ridiculous speculation that it might be a UFO landing site, most sensible ideas involve rituals. Across cultures, human rituals involve sound, whether for celebration or for mourning. So it is probably safe to assume that speech, music, and other sounds were played within stone circles. My colleague Bruno Fazender and musicologist Rupert Till went through a standard acoustician's ritual of bursting balloons one morning at Stonehenge, just after sunrise. Bruno told me that the sunlight catching the mist and clouds cutting through the circle of stones stunned him with its beauty, but he was less impressed by the sound. When he stood in the middle and clapped his hands or burst a balloon, he could hear only a faint echo from the partial remains of the Sarsen circle, the iconic uprights that are capped with horizontal stones. Unfortunately, modern-day Stonehenge is very different from its ancient counterpart, and not just because of the polluting noise from the nearby road. With many stones removed or rearranged, the modern acoustic is a poor imitation of any past sonic glories. To go back in time to hear the past acoustic, Bruno and Rupert decided to travel nearly 8,000 kilometers, 5,000 miles, because, extraordinarily, there is a full-scale replica of Stonehenge in Maryhill, Washington. Constructed by a wealthy American named Sam Hill to honor his fallen companions in World War I, the monument was completed when the altar stone was dedicated on July 4, 1918. On a trip to England, Hill had been told about possible human sacrifices at Stonehenge and had decided that a copy of the prehistoric monument would be a fitting tribute to the suffering and loss of servicemen from Clickitat County. Bruno and Rupert made detailed field measurements at the Maryhill Monument one hot and dusty summer, annoying dog walkers and tourists with loud drumming and chirps as they tried to capture and understand the acoustic. They rose early in the morning so that they could get going before the winds had a chance to pick up and create too much buffeting noise on the microphones. Fortunately, the monument was carefully constructed as a faithful replication of one of the old layouts of Stonehenge. Still, some differences between the monument and the original Stonehenge remain. The concrete blocks at Maryhill are too perfectly square and have a finish reminiscent of a 1970s textured ceiling, whereas each Stonehenge stone has individual character from the way the stones were shaped. From my knowledge of designing acoustic reflectors for concert halls, however, I would doubt this made a vast difference to the sound within the circle. Maryhill is quite awesome, a beautiful architectural place on the banks of the Columbia River. It is also a valuable archaeological model, a window into the past, giving you a sense of what it would have been like standing in the original Stonehenge, Bruno explained to me. He also described how his footfall on the gravel changed as he entered the circle, giving a striking, unexpected sense of being inside a room. Exactly the same feeling described by Hardy in Tess of the D'Urbervilles. At first, the results of the acoustic measurements surprised me. Burst a balloon at Maryhill, and the sound will ring and reverberate for over a second, a decay time more in common with a school hall than an outdoor space. Given that there is no roof and there are spaces between the stones, I naturally assumed sound would rapidly disappear up to the heavens, but actually, some sound stays bouncing around horizontally among the stones. However, the acoustic is subtler than that of a booming school hall because the reflections are quieter. You have to listen carefully to notice the difference. Nevertheless, these reflections would have been helpful during rituals. As Bruno explained, it is a surprisingly good place for speech because reflections reinforce your voice and you can talk to people even from behind some of the inner stones. Whereas the insides of the stones at Stonehenge have been carefully and meticulously worked to make a smoother, more concave shape, the outsides are often quite rough. Pioneering acoustic archaeologists Aaron Watson and David Keating have suggested that the purpose of smoothing the stone interiors might have been to focus the sound. However, Bruno heard no distinct echo caused by focusing from the rings of rocks in the Maryhill Monument. The outer sarsen stones might have produced a focused echo on their own, but reflections from the inner ring of stones hid whatever echo there might have been. The ear combines reflections that arrive at roughly the same time. At Maryhill, the sounds bouncing off the inner and outer stones arrive too close together to be perceived separately, rendering inaudible any possible echo. Bruno and Rupert had hoped to hear a whispering gallery effect around the circle of stones, but the gaps between the stones ruin this effect. Neither did they hear bass drones on Hardy's Temple of the Winds, even when a gale was blowing through the stones in the afternoon. The chance to experience an ancient resonance like the one that eluded Bruno Fazenda at Stonehenge is what drew me to the Neolithic burial mound at Wayland Smithy. I also had a less noble motivation, a curiosity to sample a chamber that featured in an infamous academic publication. In 1994, Robert Yarn and collaborators carried out what they described as rudimentary acoustical measurements inside six ancient structures. What they found was that the chambers contained acoustic resonances. Just like a Roman wine jug, a beer bottle contains air with a particular resonant frequency, which is why you can make a flute-like hooting sound when you blow across the top of one. More specifically, when you blow across the mouth of a bottle, a small plug of air in the neck begins vibrating back and forth against an air spring created by the rest of the vessel. Blowing across the mouth of another bottle, identical except for an elongated neck, sounds a lower frequency note. The elongated neck means that a longer plug of air is oscillating, and because this greater quantity of air is heavier, the resonant frequency is lower. Paul Devereux, one of Yarn's collaborators, claimed in a 2001 book that the ancient structures had specific resonant frequencies that enhanced the human voice in an intentional way. This assertion irked acoustic scientist and mathematician Matthew Wright, who noted that all enclosed spaces, such as bathrooms or burial chambers, have resonances, rarely as dramatic or obvious as that emanating from an empty beer bottle, but still powerful enough to fool you into thinking you are a great singer while showering. Wright composed a conference paper entitled, "Is a Neolithic Burial Chamber Different from My Bathroom, Acoustically Speaking?" I decided to put Wright's research to the test by analyzing the balloon bursts from Wayland Smithy and measurements I made in my bathroom. Both plots are jagged lines with distinct peaks and troughs. The peaks represent the frequencies where there are resonances. Any singer will find notes at these frequencies sounding richer and fuller than normal. If you were to sing a note a little above 100 Hz in one of these places, you would excite a resonance that would reinforce and enrich the sound. Move up to about 150 Hz, a musical interval of a perfect fifth, the leap between the first two notes of the Star Wars theme, and the valleys in the graphs at that frequency show that there is no prominent resonance to reinforce your voice, so it would sound thinner. The 100 Hz resonance is conveniently located toward the bottom of my vocal range, ideally suited for impersonating Barry White singing "Can't Get Enough of Your Love, Babe," a song slightly more appropriate in a bathroom than in a burial mound. The peaks in the plots demonstrate how acoustically similar the bathroom and burial mound are. Burial chambers and bathrooms are similar in size, big enough to get into and lay a body down, whether for disposal of the dead or for a soak in the bath. This means they both have resonances that are in a frequency range useful for enhancing singing. Matthew Wright's paper concluded that it is unlikely that acoustics influence the design of burial chambers. After my own scientific exploration, I'm afraid I agree. The cross shape of the Wayland Smithy has no discernible effect compared to a simple box. Either kind of small room would have blessed our ancestors with resonant frequencies that would have added a booming quality to chanting and singing, if that is what they did around the decomposing bodies of their kin. Because we listen through 21st century ears, which have become accustomed to hearing reflections from and within buildings most of the time, it is easy to forget how unusual the acoustics of burial chambers and stone circles would have been to our ancient ancestors. Whatever drove the design of Stonehenge, Wayland Smithy, and other prehistoric sites, we must rediscover our ancestors' listening skills to really understand the archaeology. And that begins with listening to animals.